This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Becoming the Archangel Michael's Companions, Rudolf Steiner's Challenge to the Younger Generation. This is Lecture 12, given in Stuttgart on October 14, 1922. From what has been said during the last few days, it will be clear that today one human being meets another in a different way from what was the case in the past. And this is of quite recent date. In fact, it entered human evolution with the beginning of the 20th century. In poetic language, no longer capable of doing so today, former ages foretold what has come for the whole of humanity in this century. Former ages spoke of how at the end of the 19th century the so-called Dark Age would have run its course, and that in a new age, quite new conditions must enter into human evolution. These conditions will be difficult to attain, because at first humanity is not accustomed to them. In spite of the fact that we have now entered an epoch of light, much will seem more chaotic than what was brought by the long, gloomy age of darkness. We must not merely translate into our language what was formerly presented in a picture derived from ancient clairvoyant vision. Then we would understand only the old again. We must learn to perceive it anew with the spiritual means of today. We must permeate ourselves deeply with the consciousness that in this epoch, for the first time, human eye, capital, meets human eye, in an interaction of souls that is free of all veils. Were we to go back to the first epoch after the great Atlantean flood, to the 7th or 8th millennium before Christ, we would find that adult human beings actually encountered one another in the way that today only the child encounters adults, with comprehension of the complete human being, as I characterized it yesterday. A comprehension where soul and spirit are not found separated from the body, but where the physical body is perceived as being of the nature of soul and spirit. In the epoch I have called the ancient Indian, which followed immediately upon the Atlantean catastrophe, the human being did not speak of the soul and spirit as separate in the abstract way that we do today, with a certain justification. It is precisely expressions used in this most ancient epoch, which seem to us entirely spiritual, that are misunderstood today. We misunderstand them because we believe that in the first post-Atlantean epoch of culture, people overlooked all they saw in the outer world and were only willing to point to what existed beyond the world of the senses. This was by no means the case. They had a much fuller perception of, let us say, a human movement, or of the play of expression on a countenance, or of the way young people grow in 5 years, or of the formative development of new leaves and blossoms in a plant, or in an animal of the way the whole of its forces pour into the hoof and other parts of its leg. These human beings directed their gaze into what we call the world of the senses, but in the material processes they saw the spiritual. For them, what presented itself to their senses in the material world was at the same time spiritual. Naturally, such perception was only possible because over and above what we see in the sense world, they actually perceived in their way the spiritual. For instance, they saw not only the meadow carpeted with flowers, but over the flowers they saw in a vibrating, active existence the cosmic forces that draw the plants forth from the earth. In a certain way they saw, it seems peculiar to modern human beings, but I am telling you facts, how human beings bear on their heads a kind of etheric astral cap. In this etheric astral cap, they experienced the forces underlying the growth of the hair. People today are prone to believe that the hair grows out of the head simply by being pushed out from inside, whereas the truth is that outer nature draws it forth. In olden times, people saw the reality of things, which later shone through the culture as an artistic expression. Consider the helmet of Pallas Athena. We do not rightly experience this helmet, if we think of it as having been put on. It is not put on. It is bestowed by a concentration of raying cosmic forces that are working around the head of Pallas Athena and densifying, so that in olden times it would have seemed impossible to the Greek to form the head of Pallas Athena without this covering. They would have experienced it just as we today would experience a scalped head. I am not saying that this was the case among Greeks of later times. In ancient times, people were able to experience the sense world as something soul-spiritual, because they were to experience something of an etheric and soul-spiritual nature. But these people did not ascribe any special importance to the soul and spirit. People readily believed that in the oldest mysteries, the pupils were principally taught that the sense world is semblance and the spiritual world the only reality. But this is not true. The strivings of the mysteries were directed to making the material world comprehensible to the human soul by the roundabout way of comprehending what is of the nature of soul and spirit. Already in the epoch of the first post-Atlantean culture, the mysteries were striving to understand the human being, soul spiritually, in the form he or she has on earth, not theoretically, and namely to feel inwardly and to interpret what any manifestation of the physical human being means spiritually. For example, it would have been impossible for them to have a mechanistic explanation of walking, because they knew that when human beings walk, they have an experience with every step. Today, this experience lies deep beneath the threshold of consciousness. Why do we walk? When we stretch our leg forward and put down our foot, we come into a different relation to the earth and to the heavens. And in the perception of this change, that we place one foot, for instance, into a different degree of warmth, as in a bath, from that in which the other foot has remained, there lies something that is not only mechanical, but distinctly super-dynamic. This was the perception in more ancient times. The gaze of the human being then was directed to the human's external form, to the external movements. And it would never have occurred to the people of that time to imagine that what they saw as a play of the features in nature, the growth and configuration of plants, the growth and configuration of animals, was to be interpreted in the way that we do scientifically today. There was something altogether different in the human heart and mind when a person belonging to the old Indian civilization, to which I referred yesterday, felt it as entirely natural that during a certain period of the year, the earth breathes in the being of the heavens, and during another period of the year, it does not breathe in the being of the heavens, but works within itself by shutting it out. Naturally, it was different in ancient India, because the climatic conditions were different. But were we, in imagination, to describe our own climatic conditions, we would have to say, during the summer the earth sleeps, gives herself up to the heavenly forces, and receives the power of the sun in such a way that this power of the sun pours into the earth's unconsciousness. Summer is the sleep of the earth. Winter is its waking. During the winter, the earth thinks. Through its own forces, what it thought in relation with the heavens while sleeping and dreaming during the summer. In the winter, the earth works over in her own being what has come to her through the influence of the forces and powers of the cosmos during the summer. Today, little more is known of these things in practical knowledge than that the farmer puts potatoes into the ground and leaves them there through the winter. But nobody thinks about the fate of these potatoes, because people have lost the ability to understand the being of nature. It would never have occurred to human beings, who felt as the ancient Indians did, to look out into nature at animals, plants, and minerals, shining and sparkling in their most varied colors, and to imagine that in this there is one single reality, a dance of atoms, that would have seemed utterly unreal. Certainly many will object that people need this dance of atoms in order to make calculations about nature, Yes, that is just it. People believe they need the dance of atoms to be able to make calculations about nature. Calculations in those days meant being able to live in numbers and magnitudes themselves, and not having to attach these numbers and magnitudes to what is only densified materiality. I do not want to raise objections against the good service that densified materiality renders today. Yet one must state how different the configuration of souls was in that more ancient age. Then another age came. In my book title Outline of Esoteric Science, I have called it the Old Persian. In this age, everything was built upon the principle of authority. People preserved, during the whole of their life, what is today experienced in a dull, repressed form between the 7th and 14th years. They took it with them into later life. It was more intimate, but at the same time more intense. In a certain sense, human beings looked through the external movement, through the human being's external physiognomy, or through a flower. They looked at something that was less concrete outwardly. What they saw gradually became only a manifestation of true reality. For the first post-Atlantean epoch of civilization, the whole external world was reality, but spiritual reality. Human beings were spirit. They had a head, two arms, and a body, and that was human spirit. There was nothing to deter the ancient Indians from addressing the human beings they saw standing on two legs with arms and a head as spirit. In the next epoch, people already saw through things more. What they saw was more in the nature of a surface, behind which something more etheric was perceived, a human being who was more a light form. People had the faculty of seeing this light form, because atavistic clairvoyance was still present. And then came the epoch of the third post-Atlantean culture. One felt the need for penetrating still further into the inner being of the human being, or of nature. The outer had become clearly sense-perceptible, and people were beginning to look through the outer perceptible to the spirit and soul within. The Egyptians, who belonged to this epoch of the third post-Atlantean culture, mummified the human body. In the epoch of the old Indian culture, mummification would have made no sense, for it would have been a fettering of the spirit. One had to distinguish between body and spirit when one became inclined to practice mummification. Otherwise, people would have felt they were imprisoning the human spirit if the body had been mummified, because no distinction had yet been made between body and spirit. Among the Greeks, and actually into our own time, there was already a clearly established separation between the body and the spirit and soul. Today we can do nothing other than keep these two apart, the bodily and the soul spiritual. Thus in earlier epochs, human beings really saw the I, capital, through the sheaths. Imagine the ancient Indians. They did not look at a person's eye. Their language was such that it really only expressed outwardly visible gestures and outwardly visible surfaces. The whole character of Sanskrit, if studied according to its spirit and not according to its content, is of the nature of gesture and of surface. It expresses itself above all in movement and contour. The eye was therefore seen through the sheath of the physical body in the ancient epoch, in the next epoch through the sheath of the etheric, in the third epoch through the sheath of the astral. And the human eye still remained indefinite until in our epoch it cast off its veil as it entered into human interaction. One does not adequately describe the decisive point that entered modern evolution unless one points out that in the relationship of eye to eye, free from the sheaths, something totally new entered human development, albeit slowly. I shall certainly not speak in the usual sense of our age being an age of transition, for which age is not. Every age is an age of transition from the preceding one to the one that follows. And as long as one simply says that our age is an age of transition, it is just a hollow phrase. It will make sense only when one describes what makes a transition. In our age, we are going over from experiencing the other person through sheaths to a real experience of the other person's I. And this is the difficulty in our life of soul, that we have to live into this quite new relation between person and person. Do not think that we must learn all the teachings about the I. It is not a question of learning theories about the I. No matter whether you are a farmer, a hand worker, or a scholar, it holds good for all of you that at the present time, inasmuch as we have to do with civilized people, the eye of each meets the other eye without sheaths. But that gives the whole cultural development its special coloring. Try to develop a feeling for how in the Middle Ages there was still much that was elementary in the way in which one human being experienced another. Let us imagine ourselves in a medieval town. Let us say a locksmith meets a town councillor in the street. Now, what was experienced was not just that the locksmith knew the other to be a town councillor. The experience was not exhausted by the locksmith knowing that the people had elected this person. It is true there existed links that gave people a certain stamp. One belonged to the tailor's guild, one to the locksmith's guild, but this was experienced in a more instinctive way. And when locksmiths met town councillors, they knew from other sources than from the directory, they are town councillors, for they walked differently, their look was different, and they carried their head differently. People knew that they were town councillors from things other than documents or the newspaper. Human beings experience the other, but through his or her sheaths. In the sense of modern evolution, we must experience human beings from now on without sheaths. This has gradually come about. But in a certain sense, humanity is afraid of it. If we had a cultural psychology, then it would describe, in connection with recent centuries, people's fear of being obliged to consort with another human being whose eye is unsheathed. When we picture this, we might say that those people who in the last century really experienced their own times had frightened eyes. EYE. These frightened eyes, which you would not have been able to find either among the Greeks or the Romans, make their appearance in the middle of the 16th century. We can follow these frightened eyes in literature. For instance, one can form a clear mental picture on reading the writings of Bacon of Verulam. We can glean from his writings with what eyes he looked out at the world. And still more so with Shakespeare. They can be pictured quite clearly. One need only supplement the words by the descriptions which circulated of Shakespeare's appearance. And so we must picture the people of recent centuries, who lived most deeply in their own times, as having frightened eyes, an unconsciously frightened look. At least once in their lives they had this frightened look. Goethe had it, Lessing had it, Herder had it, Jean Paul never got rid of it to the day of his death. We must have an organ for perceiving these subtleties if we want to develop any understanding of historical evolution. The humanity that wants to find its way, livingly, into the 20th century must realize that those representatives of the 19th century can no longer represent the 20th. If one reads books about Goethe written in the 19th century by the Philistine Lewes or the pedant Richard M. Meyer, one does not come to a real conception of Goethe. The only literary work of the last third of the 19th century that can still give an idea of Goethe is titled Goethe by Hermann Grimm. But that is a nightmare to those suffering from the great cultural disease of modern times, Philistinism. For in this vast volume on Goethe you find the sentence, quote, "Faust is a work that has come down from heaven," close quote. Just imagine what the commentators who pull everything to pieces have said, and imagine that someone comes along and says this should not be pulled to pieces. This may not seem important, yet we must notice such things in speaking about cultural phenomena. Read the first chapter of Grimm's Raphael, and you will have the feeling that it must be an abomination to every Orthodox professor. Nevertheless, something of it can be taken over into the 20th century. for the very reason that for the orthodox professor, nothing in it is right. Thus, one saw human beings without sheaths. Now we must learn to see them as I beings without sheaths, capital I. This alarms people because they are no longer capable of sensing what I have described as the sheaths in which, for instance, one could have seen our town councillor. It is no longer possible, at any rate not in Middle Europe, to give people outer representations of the sheaths. For the outer representations of the sheaths still had a connection with the spiritual content existing in medieval councillors. Today I must confess it would be difficult for me to distinguish, by their outer sheaths, between a civil service councillor and a private councillor. In the days when the military was at its height, one could still discern the difference, but one had to study it, to learn it through careful study. It was no longer connected with elemental human experience. So there existed a kind of terror, and people made themselves indifferent to it by means of what I described yesterday as the web of intellectualism that spreads itself around us and within which all are caught. In the cultural centers which have retained something of the East, the inner is still brought into a relation with the outer, the elemental with the intellectualistic. Those of you who come from Vienna will know that in the last century, this could be felt strongly. For in Vienna, for instance, a man who wore spectacles was known as doctor. People did not bother about the diploma, but rather about the exterior. And anyone who could afford to take a cab was a baron. It was the exterior. There was still a feeling of wanting to live within what can be described in words. The great transition to this newer age consists in human being meeting human being free of the sheaths, according to each person's inner dispositions, to what the soul demands. But the capacities for this encounter without sheaths have not yet been acquired. Above all, we have not yet acquired the possibility for a relation between I and I. But this must be prepared for through education. That is why the question of education is of such burning importance. And now, let me tell you quite frankly, when the great step forward can first be made in the way of educating the individual I-humans of the new age. But I beg you not to use what I am going to say to impress other people who are of an opposite opinion, for if you do so, the only result will be a terrible scolding and cursing of anthroposophy. We shall work rightly in education only when we have learned to feel a certain bashfulness about speaking about it at all, when we feel abashed at the idea of talking about education. This is astonishing, but it is true. The way in which education is being talked about will be regarded as shameless in future. Today everyone talks about it, and about what one considers to be right. But education does not allow itself to be tied down to formal concepts, nor is it anything we come to by theorizing. Education is something that one grows into by getting older and meeting younger human beings. Only when one has grown older and stands before younger people, and through this meeting of younger people, and through having been young once oneself, one draws near to the I, can education become natural. Many suggestions about education today seem to me no different from the content, horrible dictums, of the book of the once famous Knigge, who also gave directions as to how adults should be approached. It is the same with books on good form and breeding. Therefore, what I have said and written about education, and what is attempted practically in the Waldorf School, aims only at saying as much as possible about the characteristics of human beings, in order to learn to know the human being and not to give directions. Quote, "You should do this in such and such a way," close quote. Knowledge of the human being is what must be striven for, and the rest left to God, if I may use this religious expression. True knowledge of the human being makes the human being into a teacher, for we should really get the feeling that we are ashamed to talk about education. But under the cultural conditions of today, we have to do many things that ought to make us ashamed. The time will come, however, when we shall no longer need to talk about education. Today, these ways of thinking are lacking, but only since a little more than 100 years. For read Fichte or Schiller thoughtfully. You will find in their writings what seems quite disturbing to modern people. They have spoken, for example, about the state, and about all kinds of arrangements to make the state into what it should be. And they have spoken about the aim of the state, saying morality must be such that the state becomes superfluous, that human beings are capable out of themselves of becoming free agents, capable through their morality of making the state superfluous. Fichte said that the state should be an institution which gives over the reins and gradually becomes entirely superfluous. Today this would make a similar impression as the following incident on a troupe of actors. A play had been performed for the 50th time by a traveling company, and the director said, quote, "Now that we have performed this for the 50th time, the prompter's box can be dispensed with," close quote. But the actors were quite terrified at the idea. Finally, one of them pulled himself together and said, quote, "But sir, then one will see the prompter," close quote. This is about what would happen with human beings today. They do not see that the prompter, too, can be dispensed with. The state will have found its best constitution when it makes itself superfluous. Yes, but what would all the government officials and the chancellors and the private councillors say to such a thing? We must bring ourselves out of the everyday practice and set ourselves within this great change going on in the depths of modern souls, if we are to realize that we must come to the point where talk about education is as superfluous as it was in older cultural epochs. Education was not talked about in earlier days. The science of education first arose when people could no longer educate out of the primal forces of their beings. But this is more important than is supposed. Boys or girls, seeing the teacher come into the classroom, must not have the feeling that the teacher is teaching according to theoretical principles, because he or she does not grasp the subconscious. They want a human relation with the teacher. That is, however, destroyed when educational principles are introduced. Therefore, if we are to get back to a natural condition of authority between young and old, it is of infinite importance and an absolute necessity that education shall not be talked about so much. There is no need to talk or think about education as much as is done today. For there are still many spheres in which education is conducted according to quite sound principles, although they are also already being undermined. You see, theoretically, it is all quite clear. And theoretically, people know how to handle the matter, just as it is handled by the academic opinion of the present day. But in practice, it is quite good if there should happen to anyone what happened to me. A friend had scales by his plate and weighed the different foods in order to take the right quantity of each into his organism. From the physiological point of view, this may be quite correct. However, picture this transposed into the realm of education. Unfortunately, it does happen, even if in a primitive way. It is more wholesome when this happens intuitively, if parents, instead of buying some special physiological work on nourishment, judge how to feed their children through the feeling for how they themselves ate as children. And so in pedagogy, we must overcome everything that lays down rules, such as how much food should be taken into the stomach, and strive in the sphere of education for real insight into the nature and being of the human being. This insight into the nature of the human being will have consequences for the whole of human life. Whoever comes to an understanding of the human being in the way I have been describing during these days, and thereby imbues this knowledge with an artistic attitude, will remain young. For there is some truth in it that once we have grown up, we are actually impoverished human beings. Yet the most important thing for the human being is that we have forces of growth within us. What we have in us as a child is of the utmost importance for the human being. We are led back to this in inner experience through true knowledge of the human being. We really become childlike when we acquire the right knowledge of the human being and become thereby suited to meet young people and children in the right way. We must strive, not in an egoistical sense, as often happens today, to say, "Except ye become as little children, ye cannot enter the kingdom of heaven." We must seek for this in practical life. If we were not imbued with an active human force that worked in us during childhood, we could never teach. Pedagogy is not enough if it makes the teachers or educators merely clever. I do not say that it should make them empty of thought, but in this way one does not become empty of thought. Pedagogy that makes teachers merely clever is not of the right kind. The right kind of pedagogy makes teachers inwardly alive and fills them with a life blood of the soul that pours itself actively into their physical life blood. And if there is anything by which we can recognize true teachers or educators, it is that their pedagogical art has not made them pedants. Now, my dear friends, that you can find a pedant working in some place is perhaps only a myth or a legend. If teachers are pedants, if these myths and legends are founded on truth, then we may be sure that the pedagogy has taken a wrong road. To avoid giving offense, I must assume these legends and myths to be hypothetical and say, if pedants and Philistines were to be found in the teaching profession, it would be a sign that our education is going under. Education is on the ascent only when, in its experience and whole way of working, pedantry and Philistinism are driven right out of the human being. The true teacher can be no Philistine, can be no pedant. In connection with this, so that you may be able to check what I have been saying, I ask you to consider from what vocation in life the word pedant is derived. Then perhaps you will be able to contribute to the recognition of the reality of what has been indicated. I do not want to elaborate on it, because already much that I have said is being taken amiss. It is only on this condition that we can have a right pedagogy. Otherwise, it would have to become a pedagogy in accordance with what I have been giving you in these lectures. Thus, in the lecture tomorrow, I will attempt to bring these talks to some conclusion. The end of Lecture 12.